These latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. Thai officials say this week's deadly Bangkok shrine bombing was likely planned by at least 10 people, including some foreigners, but is not believed to have been carried out by an international terror group. Earlier, the national police chief said at least 10 people were involved in planning the attack, which killed at least 22 people and injured hundreds more. The government on Wednesday issued an arrest warrant for a young man with black shaggy hair, stubble, and round plastic-framed glasses. A sketch of the foreign man was also released. There is a $28,000 reward for info leading to his capture. An Islamic State-affiliated group has claimed responsibility for a large car bomb attack outside a state security building in Cairo early Thursday, wounding dozens in the country's latest militant attack. Local officials say at least six policemen were among those hurt by the massive blast, which ripped the facade off the government building and shattered windows of surrounding structures. Eyewitnesses say the bombers parked the explosives-laden car outside the government facility before escaping in another vehicle. Burundi's President Pierre Nkurunziza has been sworn in for his third term in a surprise ceremony 6 days before the scheduled inauguration. The president's office had told VOA Central Africa Service on Wednesday that he would be sworn in on August 26th. Instead, Mr. Nkurunziza took the oath of office Thursday at the National Assembly in the capital, Bujumbura. The president's new five-year term has been criticized by some as violating the Constitution and the Arusha Accords that effectively ended Burundi's 13-year civil war. This is VOA News. The Associated Press says a draft of a side agreement to the Iranian nuclear agreement between the UN Atomic Watchdog Agency and Tehran will allow Iran to use its own inspectors to investigate the secretive Parchin nuclear site. VOA's Victor Beatty reports the revelation comes just weeks before the U.S. Congress votes on whether to reject the deal.
The Obama administration Wednesday expressed confidence in the technical plans of the International Atomic Energy Agency for investigating Parchin and previous possible military dimensions of Iran's nuclear program. John Kirby, a U.S. State Department spokesman, says while familiar with the contents, he would not comment directly on the purported draft document by the IAEA.
The IAEA is comfortable with arrangements which are unique to the agency's investigation of Iran's historical activities. When it comes to monitoring Iran's behavior going forward, the IAEA has separately developed the most robust inspection regime ever peacefully negotiated to ensure Iran's current program.
Congress is expected to vote on the Iran nuclear agreement when it returns from a recess next month. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
The United States is reportedly blocking a military aid disbursement because Islamabad allegedly has made insufficient headway fighting the Haqqani terrorist network, according to a Pakistan newspaper. The Dawn newspaper says U.S. officials determined a counter-terrorism offensive that began last June in North Waziristan has not damaged the feared group. If the Obama administration does not certify to the U.S. Congress that Pakistan's military operations have significantly damaged the Haqqani network, it will hold up the next payment of coalition support funds. This is the money reimbursed to Pakistan for actions that helped the U.S. military in Afghanistan. Two of the leading 2016 U.S. Republican presidential contenders, real estate mogul Donald Trump and former Florida Governor Jeb Bush, are taunting each other 5 months before the country's first party primary election. Trump and Bush held dueling town hall rallies with voters just a few kilometers apart Wednesday in New Hampshire, where Republicans will vote in February. Early political surveys of Republicans have shown Trump in the lead nationally. Protesters clashed with police in St. Louis, Missouri Wednesday after a young black man was shot and killed during a confrontation with officers. St. Louis Police Chief Sam Dotson said 18-year-old Mansour Balbay was killed when he pointed a gun at two white police officers as they were serving a search warrant on a house. As word of the shooting spread, neighborhood residents gathered at the scene and angrily demonstrated against the shooting. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
I think it's just horrendous that these allegations continue to flow in from this one country where the media has trained its attention, and there's something desperately wrong with the way that peacekeeping is being managed from headquarters when we see this tremendous cavalcade of allegations of rape by peacekeepers.
That's Paula Donovan of AIDS Free World reacting to the latest sex abuse allegations against UN peacekeepers in CAR. We'll have details coming up. Also in the news, an Islamic State affiliated group claims responsibility for a large car bomb attack outside a state security building in Cairo early today. Burundi's President Pierre Nkurunziza has been sworn in for his third term in a surprise ceremony 6 days before the scheduled inauguration. And Britain and France are creating a new command and control center in response to attempts by thousands of migrants this year to cross the English Channel illegally. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Rwanda, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, an Islamic State-affiliated group has claimed responsibility for a large car bomb attack outside a state security building in Cairo early today, wounding dozens in the country's latest militant attack. Local officials say at least six policemen were among those hurt by the massive blast, which ripped the facade off the government building and shattered windows of surrounding structures in the residential neighborhood Shabra. Eyewitnesses say the bombers parked the explosives-laden car outside the government facility before escaping in another vehicle. The blast was so loud that it awoke residents throughout the capital, according to social media posts. Soldiers of the Islamic Caliphate carried out the attack, according to a statement by a Twitter account linked to the Sinai province, which has claimed allegiance with the Islamic State. Well, just days after South Sudan President Salva Kiir threatened to kill journalists for reporting what he called against the country, a journalist has been shot dead. Peter Moy was killed last night after leaving work in Juba. His body was found in the residential area of Karok. Moy had worked for the corporate newspaper. Oliver Modi, chairman of the Union of Journalists of South Sudan, called the killing intentional. Tom Rhodes is the East Africa representative for the Committee to Protect Journalists. From Nairobi, he spoke with South Sudan and Focus reporter Ian Buor about Moy's death.
It is rather foreboding, but it's too early to tell what has happened to Peter. But it shows a worrying sign and a worrying trend. When we see the president on Sunday afternoon threatening to kill journalists before departing to Addis, and then Wednesday night, a journalist is shot. Furthermore, my sources tell me that his mobile phone and money was still intact in his pocket, which would seem to suggest that the cause of death was not due to a robbery.
And Tom, your organization has listed South Sudan as the second deadliest country for journalists in 2015. In your own words, could you tell me how deadly is South Sudan?
The sad truth is it didn't used to be like this. It was quite a safe place to work. We had an incident in 2012, but this year we've had an unprecedented number of journalists killed. Five in Western Bahr-Ghazal State, one in Jonglei State, and now here in the capital in Juba. So the numbers speak for themselves that things are getting more and more dangerous for journalists. And my fear is that as political uncertainties continue with this ongoing peace process discussions and ongoing conflict, we're not going to see that trend changing anytime soon.
And Tom, I just wanted to get your opinion on what can be done to protect the lives of journalists in South Sudan.
For one, we need the government, and particularly the security forces, to adhere to their own laws and stop, you know, arbitrarily arresting and closing down media houses without any recourse to the law or the constitution, which protects press freedom. And that would be probably the first step. Journalists themselves need to, you know, really consider their own security more in their reporting. You know, don't walk home alone, walk in a buddy system. Use sort of tactics for online communication, secure online communication. There's a lot that we could all do to prevent these kind of tragic incidences happening in the future.
Tom Rhodes is the East Africa representative for the Committee to Protect Journalists. From Nairobi, he spoke with South Sudan and Focus reporter Ian Bior. More allegations of sex abuse by UN peacekeepers in the Central African Republic were revealed yesterday. Three young women, including a minor, say they were raped by peacekeepers in Bambari, a city where troops are stationed. The UN Secretary General's office says families of the young women made what it called disturbing allegations August 12th. And a statement from the peacekeeping mission says UN headquarters was notified immediately. At the time of the alleged incident, the only UN troops in Bambari were from the DRC. Among those criticizing the way the UN has handled the ongoing sex abuse allegations is Paula Donovan. She's co-director of the group AIDS Free World, which launched the Code Blue campaign. Its goal is to end immunity for sexual exploitation and abuse by UN peacekeeping personnel. From Boston, Donovan spoke to VOA's Joe DiCampoa about these latest charges.
I think it's just horrendous that these allegations continue to flow in from this one country where the media has trained its attention, and there's something desperately wrong with the way that peacekeeping is being managed from headquarters when we see this tremendous cavalcade of allegations of rape by peacekeepers.
You call this an ongoing crisis that is clearly out of control. Why?
Well, because no part of the system is working. The Department of Peacekeeping Operations isn't controlling the senior managers who are sent out to the field to run these operations. The force commanders aren't controlling their troops. The special representatives aren't informing headquarters, or if they are, headquarters is not informing the public or the governments involved. There's just mismanagement from top to bottom, and the UN is taking the role of the helpless bystander in all of this rather than taking responsibility for the fact that they're managing a worldwide effort that costs billions of dollars every year in a way that's just not working for the civilian populations that peacekeeping is designed to protect.
Didn't UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon make a personnel change a few months ago to deal with this issue?
He made one administrative decision to fire the special representative in the Central African Republic. He announced that on the day that another allegation of rape was received by the Central African Republic, and didn't speak about the fact that this firing was provoked by one particular rape case. But since he had decided to fire this one particular special representative, yet another rape case had come in with three people who came forward to the MINUSCA, the peacekeeping mission, to say that their family members had been raped. Two women and one minor girl came forward on August 12th to say that they had also been raped by UN peacekeepers, and this was not mentioned at all by the Secretary General during his special session with the Security Council the following day.
Now, let me ask you about the Code Blue campaign. Of course, we've spoken about this before. How long has it been going on now, and what is your ultimate goal?
We launched the campaign in May of this year after doing about a year and a half of research and trying to figure out just exactly where the problems were and what the root of the problem is. And we feel as though we honed in on the source of these problems, and that's number one, that the member states are unaware of how bad the situation is at the senior leadership level of the United Nations, and that needs to be investigated by a truly external, entirely independent group that is commissioned by member states, not by the Secretary General himself, to look into peacekeeping. And a really important source of the problem is the immunity that UN peacekeeping personnel who are hired by the United Nations itself enjoy. The Secretary General says that he has a zero tolerance for sexual exploitation and abuse policy, and that therefore immunity doesn't weigh in when one of his personnel is accused of one of these crimes or what they call misconduct. But in fact, immunity is what blocks the normal justice process and prevents the UN from immediately turning over an allegation to the appropriate authorities so that a thorough, justified, impartial investigation can take place right away without delay.
Paula Donovan is co-director of the group AIDS Free World, which launched the Code Blue campaign. From Boston, she spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua. Burundi's President Pierre Nkurunziza has been sworn in for his third term in a surprise ceremony 6 days before the scheduled inauguration. The president's office had told VOA Central Africa Service yesterday that he would be sworn in on August 26th. Instead, Mr. Nkurunziza took the oath of office today at the National Assembly in the capital, Bujumbura, with no foreign heads of state present. The president's new five-year term has been criticized by some as violating the Constitution and the Arusha Accords that effectively ended Burundi's 13-year civil war. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. Coming up on 17 minutes past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. An Islamic State-affiliated group claims responsibility for a large car bomb attack outside a state security building in Cairo early today. In Central African Republic, three young women, including a minor, say they were raped by peacekeepers in Bambari, a city where troops are stationed. And Burundi's president has been sworn in for his third term in a surprise ceremony 6 days before the scheduled inauguration. And for more news and information, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. A look at more developments. Britain and France are creating a new command and control center in the French port city of Calais. The move comes in response to attempts by thousands of migrants this year to cross the English Channel illegally. At least 10 migrants have died attempting the France to Britain passage to search for work. The agreement includes posting British officers in Calais to fight human trafficking operations and constructing a control center near the entrance to the Eurotunnel, where migrants to catch a ride to Britain on a train or truck. Elsewhere regarding the migrant and refugee crisis, the Greek government is ferrying about 2,500 migrants to the mainland today, easing pressure on small islands overwhelmed by a large summer migration. The ferry left the Greek island of Kos yesterday with 1,300 on board. The vessel stopped to load hundreds more from other islands before arriving at a port near Athens. Most of those stranded on the Greek islands are Syrians. They want to reach Germany, England, and other countries in the EU. With terrorism a rising concern in Kenya, lawmakers are considering new legislation that would allow soldiers to deploy in civilian areas to keep order. However, the proposal has run into strong opposition even before it gets to the floor of parliament. Mohammed Yusuf has more from Nairobi.
Kenya Law Society Chairman Eric Mutua says spending for all institutions in the country must be open to inspection, and the military should not be different.
Every public money which is expended is subject to account, and it is subject to account through the constitution and through the institutions which have been set up in the constitution for purposes of scrutiny. So you cannot have any funds whatsoever which cannot be subject to scrutiny.
However, Homeland Security expert Richard Tuta says the legislation is trying to make the military more useful in the fight against internal terrorism.
The intention of the bill itself is not a wrong intention. One thing that you realize the bill wants to do is how can we use our Kenya Defence Forces to supplement issues to do with homeland security, and at what point can they be called upon? And when they are called upon, how do they relate with other internal state operators within the country?
But the bill also proposes deploying the army to civilian areas to maintain order. Opposition politicians insist the army should stick to its role to protect the country from external aggression. The chairman of the political party's collaborative forum, Benjamin Mweme, says some lawmakers are using security fears to push a bad bill.
There's overreaction on the insecurity caused by terrorism. And maybe people are trying to cure the terrorism issue through making laws that are not well thought out. So it would be prudent for the laws to be thought out, to be in conformity with the constitution, and also not infringe on the rights of other Kenyans.
The chairman of Parliament's Defence and Foreign Affairs Committee said this week the panel will listen to all concerns raised by the public, political leaders and legal experts before sending the proposed legislation to Parliament for debate. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Well, Cameroon has mobilized about 500 men from its navy to Lake Chad to stop growing threats from the Boko Haram terrorist group. The men were mobilized less than a week after Cameroon announced it was contributing 2,450 troops to the N'Djamena-based multinational joint forces to fight Boko Haram. Moki Edwin Kinzika reports from Yaoundé.
Navy Chief of Staff Rear Admiral Mendua Zhang says Boko Haram fighters may be using Lake Chad and its basin to prepare attacks on states in the region after they were dislodged from their Sambisa forest hideout in raids by the Nigerian army.
Nous avons trouvé des hommes qui ont foi dans leur mission et qui ne lâchent rien, qui s'impliquent.
He says the troops in the field and those joining them will spare no efforts and neglect no details in their mission to crush the Nigerian terrorist group Boko Haram. Rear Admiral Mendua Zhang says the Navy will share information and coordinate intelligence to keep watch over Lake Chad, shared by Cameroon, Nigeria, Chad, Benin and Niger, all of them countries that have been suffering from the Boko Haram insurgency. The violence has displaced about 2 million people and killed about 20,000 in Nigeria, Cameroon, Chad and Niger. Last week, Cameroon announced it had contributed 2,450 troops to the joint forces to fight the insurgency, more than triple the 700 it had earlier pledged. Nigeria's President Muhammadu Buhari has given his military 3 months to crush the insurgents in cooperation with the 8,700 Joint Force soldiers headquartered in Chad. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Yaoundé.
A critical problem faced by many small-scale African farmers is the cost of testing their soil for nutrients. It's also been a challenge to inform suppliers about their need for specific seeds and fertilizers. But now there's a new portable and affordable kit that could change that. It's called Soil Doc. It samples soil, analyzes its chemistry, and then wirelessly transmits that information via computer tablet to the so-called cloud. The cloud is a term for software and services that run on the internet rather than a person's computer. It's where suppliers and others can access the information and act fast. Christopher Lamb oversees development and deployment of SoilDoc for the Earth Institute at Columbia University in New York. He told VOA's Adam Phillips that SoilDoc is not only useful, but unique.
SoilDoc is a mobile soil fertility assessment kit and management system. So it tests soils on the farm. It collects information from the farmer. It uploads these data to the cloud, and then fertility maps and recommendations are developed from that data. Collaborations are developed between fertilizer blenders, seed companies, traders, and other actors. And then regional seed and fertilizer blend pairings are promoted by crop and soil type. The system can be recalibrated at any time using this stream of georeference data that comes from the farm and the kit. In a nutshell, that's what the system is.
Give us an example of a real person in a real farm. Like, He goes out into the field and what?
The kit is mostly used by extension workers. So a farmer is sitting on their field. It might be a small one-hectare farm. And the extension worker shows up. They have a kit that looks like a large tool kit. And inside there are all vials and chemicals, everything you would expect in a formal wet chemistry lab. And the extension worker sits with the farmer, tests the soils, produces 11 core soil tests, then enters that data into an Android tablet, which is connected to the web, and that data is uploaded into the cloud. And in addition to that, there's a questionnaire built into the Android tablet on certain information about the farmer's basic practices, where they get their seed and fertilizer from, what kind of crop yields that they normally get. All that information is uploaded into the cloud. And then the Android will give real-time fertility recommendations to the farmer on the spot. So it'll tell them, like, you're low in phosphorus, you've got no sulfur, you need zinc added to your soil. We'll be able to tell if the soil is compacted, needs to be broken up, what crop types might work very well in this soil. We can give the farmer that information there immediately. But that itself is not the real attraction, because in the current situation, even if the farmer understands what their soil needs, they're usually not able to get those nutrients at their local agro dealer. So what we do is we take all of this information we're collecting from various farms, we go to the local fertilizer blenders, we recommend new fertilizer blends, we go to seed companies and we say, you should pair this seed with this fertilizer blend and offer them both to the farmer at the same time. And what we found is when this information is available to the farmer and they're actually able to get the nutrients they need, we can see crop yields go up a ladder, like from 1 to 2 metric tons per hectare, the following year, 2 to 3 metric tons per hectare, the following year, 4 to 5 metric tons per hectare, which obviously does wonders for the farmer's economic outlook, but also really helps the food security of the country also. We're basically acting like a mobile land-grant university to try and spur agriculture in key areas in Africa.
I know that a lot of farmers in rural areas in Africa, even the United States for that matter, are not online. I mean, often the wireless connection and all that is either weak or non-existent. How do you sort of forge a strength to that link so that they can actually use it?
The farmers themselves are not the main target for SoilDoc. The extension workers are. It's the extension worker, and we give them the Android. And as part of the program we set up, we pay for their Wi-Fi access to get their data into the system. The farmer doesn't even have to pay for anything. Down the line, if SoilDoc was to be employed by independent extension workers, the cost per test is still very low. It's under $3 a test. And when you compare that to a traditional wet lab, where a farmer would have to send their soils away to a traditional wet lab, the cost there could be $25 to $30 a test. But currently, it's the extension worker is the key market, and the extension worker is the key person that makes everything run in the SoilDoc system. And quite frankly, the extension worker is pretty much the person who makes agriculture run everywhere in the world.
Well, that sounds like very gratifying work.
It's fantastic because you actually see the results from the ground, and the results come very quickly. Like, we can see a farmer who's really struggling with food security in 2 to 3 years have a really successful little business.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and it's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. An Islamic State-affiliated group wounds dozens in a large car bomb attack outside a state security building in Cairo early today. In Central African Republic, three young women, including a minor, say they were raped by peacekeepers in Bambari, a city where troops are stationed. And Burundi's president, Pierre Nkurunziza, has been sworn in for his third term in a surprise ceremony 6 days before the scheduled inauguration. Coming up, we'll have music from Rwanda and our feature series on Eritrean migrants. I'm Kim Lewis, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Thursday, Sunny.
Happy Thursday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand World Championship Athletics tops your sports report today.
Kim, the world's top athletes are getting ready to showcase their talents at the Beijing National Stadium in China. The 2015 IAAF World Championships in Athletics, which begins Saturday, will be the largest sporting event to take place at the stadium, nicknamed the Bird's Nest, since the 2008 Olympics. The neighboring countries of Kenya and Ethiopia are once again expected to be the top-performing African teams in Beijing. At the 2013 World Championships held in Moscow, the Kenyans placed fourth overall on the medals table with 12, including 5 gold. Ethiopia was sixth overall with 10 medals, including 3 gold. Olympic 800-meter champion and world record holder David Rudisha is one of Kenya's biggest stars in China. Rudisha did not compete in Moscow 2 years ago because of a knee injury, but he's ready to go in Beijing. The heats in the men's 800 meters begin Saturday, and the final will be held next Tuesday, August 25th. Rudisha says he's trying to stay calm and keep his concentration with the racing about to begin.
The most important thing is all about, you know, how you keep your focus. Don't lose that focus, of course. Sometimes we get that nervous, but it's whereby you have to think about your race, how you're going to run, and just be cool, you know.
As he tries to stay cool and calm, David Rudisha knows he has run 6 of the 8 fastest times ever over 2 laps, including the world record of 1 minute 40.91 seconds, which he clocked to win gold in one of the big highlights of the 2012 London Olympics. Another Olympic champion and world record holder who will be closely watched in Beijing is Usain Bolt, the Jamaican sprint sensation. At a news conference in Beijing Thursday, Bolt said it's sad that he's hearing so much about doping rather than competition.
Initially, I'm running for myself. That's what I do. People know it said I need to win for the sport, but we're here, and I think there's a lot of other athletes out there that are running clean or run over the years clean through their whole career. So it's not only just on me, because I can't do it by myself. So I think it's a responsibility of all athletes to take up on yourself to help to save the sports, or to show that the sports can go far without drug treats or with athletes that have taken drugs over the years.
Usain Bolt will celebrate his 29th birthday on Friday. He and Jamaican countrywoman Shelly-Ann Fraser-Pryce were the most successful athletes at the 2013 World Championships in Moscow. They both won 3 gold medals in the men's and women's 100 meters, 200 meters, and 4x100 meters relay. This achievement also earned the Lightning Bolt the title of the most successful athlete in the history of the World Championships, with 8 gold and 2 silver medals. At the Beijing news conference, Bolt said he's ready to extend his reign as the world's fastest man.
Competition is competition. It's always who's in the best form or who executes well. I think in the 100 meters that really counts for me, but I'm ready to go. all I need to do right now is just execute. I think that's the key thing, because I haven't gotten any race, a lot of races in, but I think running through the rounds, I'll get going. I think I have to run probably the first 50 quick to really get my body into running up to speed. So I'll be all right. I'm not worried, and I never really look at statistics, because track and field, you never know what's going to happen, really.
You never know. That's the lightning bolt, Usain Bolt, getting ready to run for more gold at the World Championships in Beijing, China.
I'm Lightning Bolt. I'm not flash guarding anybody. My name is Lightning Bolt.
Hi, I'm Segun Adeyemi, coming to you all the way from Lagos, Nigeria. Weekends are for sports. Nightline Africa Sports, that is. And every Sunday, I'll give you highlights of the top sports stories of the past week and the weekend. Nightline Africa Sports from the Voice of America. Let the games begin. We got the game on.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
I'm VOA Sonny Young, and you're listening to The Sunny Side of Sports on The Voice of America. Another top athlete who will compete at the World Championships in Beijing is Jessica Ennis-Hill of Britain, the reigning Olympic champion in the 7-event women's heptathlon. How are you feeling, Jessica?
Yeah, it's obviously a nervous time for me when I'm getting ready for the hurdles. It's my first event of the 2 days, so I'm very, very nervous, very anxious. Try and get the best warm-up I can possibly get in without overdoing it, because when you're nervous and the adrenaline's going, you tend to want to do a bit too much. And then when you get in here, it's that feeling of, I've done all I can do now. I've done the training, I've done all my warm-up, and I'm ready to go, and there's not much I can change. So it's that feeling of sitting here, contemplating, getting all your thoughts together, and then getting out there and performing. So this is quite a nervous-filled area for me before I race.
Thanks, Jessica, and good luck in Beijing. That's Jessica Ennis-Hill of Britain, the reigning Olympic champion in the 7-event women's heptathlon. With more news about Beijing 2015, here's Marco Uma.
The Confederation of African Athletics president, Hamad Kalkaba Malboum, is one of the four newly elected International Association of Athletics Federations, IAAF, vice presidents, the IAAF revealed in Beijing, China, following the IAAF council elections. Britain's Sebastian Coe is the new IAAF president.
I'm very, very flattered today. Very, very honored. I haven't really had much of a chance to allow it to sink in, and I guess that's probably not going to happen for a day or two. But I joined an athletics club when I was 11. I had a 10, 12-year apprenticeship before I got to an Olympic stadium. I've had the joys of Olympic competition. I've had the joys of being a part of a team that created something very special in London a few years ago. But this, for me, is the pinnacle. It is my sport, it's my passion, it's the thing that I've always wanted to do.
From the 31st of August, he replaces Senegal's long-serving Lamine Diack, who will serve as honorary president. Meanwhile, hosts Uganda beat Kenya 33-18 as Tanzania outclassed Rwanda 59-15 in netball at the East Africa Military Games in Kampala on Wednesday. Kenya beat Burundi 3-0 as Rwanda edged Tanzania 2-1 in football. Uganda pipped Kenya 32-31 as Tanzania edged Rwanda 27-25 in handball. Uganda prevailed over Kenya 65-54 as Tanzania dismissed Burundi 74-63 in basketball. Earlier on, Rwanda edged Uganda 54-52 in basketball. Uganda and Tanzania drew 1-1 as Rwanda and Kenya drew 0-0 in football. Uganda overpowered Rwanda 77-10 as Tanzania outclassed Burundi 95-6 in netball.
Thanks, Mark. That's Mark Ouma, who provides sporty updates Monday through Friday on our Daybreak Africa radio show. Turning to tennis, South African star Kevin Anderson is through to the third round at the Cincinnati Masters Tournament in the U.S. state of Ohio. Anderson defeated American Jack Sock of the United States in straight sets on Wednesday, 6-3 and 7-6. The tall South African now has the daunting challenge of playing Swiss star Roger Federer in the next round. Reporter Catherine Whitaker caught up with Anderson and asked him, Kevin, can you take us through your victory over Jack Sock?
Oh, it got off to a great start, breaking in first game, and then it's a little interesting with the rain coming down. I felt like quite a bit of momentum at that point in time, so I knew coming back out was important to at least take care of my serve game. That was my first step, and then played a good game the next game. I actually had a few break points. I felt the match sort of settled down there a little bit. No more breaks or serve until, you know, towards the end of the second set. Played a good game to break him. Obviously not ideal losing serve when you're serving for it. I felt I'd taken care of my serve games well throughout the whole match. A little hiccup in that game, but I felt I reset really well. Tiebreak, you know, was very close, and at that stage you're just sort of scrambling and fighting for each point, and I managed to, you know, find a way to get it done in the end.
How are you finding the conditions here this week, rain aside? A lot of people are talking about how different they are to Montreal last week.
Yeah, I guess a little bit. You know, you played the one match last week in Montreal, and conditions that were quite heavy, so it's tough to, at least for me, to compare. I maybe would have liked to play a little bit more. I haven't really been a player that notices, you know, sort of massive differences. I feel like I do a good job adjusting and accepting the conditions and balls for how they are. I know a lot of people have been commenting on both of that, but from my side, I feel like the conditions are, you know, playing nicely.
Roger Federer next. Does your performance against Novak at Wimbledon just a month or so ago give you belief that you can compete with these top players?
Yeah, definitely. That was a great match, and, you know, definitely something I can take with me in my match with Roger tomorrow. I've played him a few times. The biggest thing is just treating it like another match. And I faced him a few times now. I definitely feel like I'll be able to accomplish that easier. Yeah, it's going to be a tough task. I think this is, he's had a lot of success at this tournament, definitely one of his favorite tournaments. So I'm going to have to come out and play good tennis.
South African tennis star Kevin Anderson. And Kevin was talking with reporter Catherine Whitaker in Cincinnati, Ohio. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on The Voice of America. Well, coming up in part four of our series on Eritrean migrants, is there reform in Asmara's future? And a music store in downtown Nairobi offers East African recordings on vinyl. First, here's Monty Martin of Rwanda with Don't Cry.
Usilie hauna upweke Mola yupo. Usilie hauna upweke Mola yupo. Usilie. Usilie. God is always with you. Anakujali, anakujali. Anakujali, anakujali. Wazazi wangu wamenikataa mimi. Ndugu zangu wamenichukia mimi. Sina ndugu,
sina ndugu,
sina rafiki,
sina rafiki.
Sina ndugu, sina rafiki. Niende wapi?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
katika milima na mabonde, ninatembea bila kusema, sina mtu wa kuongea naye. Binadamu wamekuwa vile vile, ukiwa na raha utawaona, ukiwa na shida watakukimbia. Lakini ninasikia wimbo, wimbo wa sauti ya mwangwi usemao usijali Mola yupo, usemao usijali Mola yupo. Please don't cry, oh please don't cry, you are not alone. Usilie hauna upweke Mola yupo, usilie hauna upweke Mola yupo, usilie, usilie. God is always with you, anakujali, 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 anakujali. Pata kimbilio la mateso duniani pande zote matatizo, sina neno nimeishiwa, sina neno nimeishiwa, katika milima na mabonde ninatembea bila kusema, sina mtu ongea naye. Binadamu wamekuwa vile vile, ukiwa na raha utawaona, ukiwa na shida watakukimbia. Lakini ninasikia wimbo, wimbo wa sauti ya mwangu usemao usijali Mola yupo, usemao usijali Mola yupo. Please don't cry, oh please.
Manny Martin with Don't Cry. Well, the small African country of Eritrea has produced large numbers of refugees who are knocking on European doors. Two big reasons are Eritrea's extreme poverty and what the UN calls an abusive system of national service. Nevertheless, Europe appears to be re-examining its earlier policies of automatic asylum for all Eritreans. Bronwyn Bruton of the Atlantic Council is an observer of Eritrea. She talked to VOA's David Arnold in part four of the series on the Eritrean migrants. Is there reform in Asmara's future?
Bronwyn Bruton first learned about Eritrea when she worked as a human rights advocate. On the Washington, D.C. staff of the National Endowment for Democracy, she trained journalists, funded the formation of Eritrean political opposition to the ruling Eritrean People's Liberation Front, and she helped Eritrean journalists fleeing persecution.
The economic situation in Eritrea is very poor. Eritrea is isolated. It hasn't had a lot of economic development opportunities, and so it's hard for people to make a living. And because there's a perception of political persecution in Eritrea, Europe, for example, has an automatic asylum policy, which means that anyone who's Eritrean can get benefits in Europe. And that, in a sense, has been a pull factor, too. So that while on the one hand there's no doubt that there are people who are fleeing Eritrea for very valid reasons of political persecution, there's also a certain number of people who are leaving Eritrea because they have a feeling that they can have a better life and better prospects in Europe.
When she moved to the Atlantic Council, where she is deputy director of the Africa Center, Bruton continued to follow the plight of Eritrea's migrants.
What happens in reality to these poor people who go over the border and who try their luck trying to get across the Sinai or trying to get across the Mediterranean, their fates are horrific. There are human traffickers. There are rumors about people harvesting organs from these poor souls. I mean, the reality is brutal and horrible.
Much of the criticism of Eritrea's government is valid, she says, from indeterminate national service to human rights abuses and the jailing of journalists. But Bruton says her earlier experience with Eritrea did not give her a complete picture of the nation. Along with some European countries, she is taking another look at Eritrea and at the blanket asylum for Eritrea's refugees.
For a while, Denmark, for example, was receiving 10 Eritreans per month. Then in the middle of last year, it skyrocketed to 514 people in last July. So when all of a sudden these European countries are being inundated with Eritreans, they have sort of an interest, political and economic interest, in stopping that flow.
Norway, the United Kingdom, and other European countries are debating their asylum policies for Eritrea. Bruton says she wants a more complete picture of Eritrea and its leadership. Bruton is one of few scholars and researchers who have visited the capital recently. She and an academic colleague met for 3 hours with President Isaias Afwerki and later with members of his inner circle of advisors.
They're doing their best to reach out to Europe to demonstrate that the narrative of human rights abuses on Eritrea is false. They're trying to repair relations. They're working very hard on health and social service programs. They're doing a lot of infrastructure work. They're courting international investors.
Bruton says Mr. Isaias and his advisors told her they are courting foreign investors. They want to speed up much-needed development, and they worry about losing so many talented Eritreans to Europe.
I heard again and again and again a sense of true frustration about the brain drain that they were experiencing. The fact that they were trying really hard, for example, to have a successful education system, but they didn't have good teachers. And every time they got a good teacher, the person would be gone a year later because they would have gone to Europe. And so I think that there's a realization now that the situation is not sustainable. I also think that there are Western investors inside Eritrea that are putting a lot of pressure on the government. For example, they need workers in the mining sector. And these Western companies don't want to touch slave labor with a 25-foot pole. And they've made it really clear to the government.
Bruton is not yet convinced that significant changes will take place in Eritrea. And as of the moment, nothing is certain about the asylum prospects in Europe for many Eritreans. They will continue to follow a trail to Europe filled with grave mortal risk. This is David Arnold reporting from Washington, D.C.
A dusty music store in downtown Nairobi was once the hotspot for East Africans recording their music. Abdul Karim's shop suffered with the introduction of CDs and MP3s. But as VOA's Gabe Joslow reports, there is now global interest in the store's East African vinyl recordings.
Okay, this is a Luo band.
This is Abdul Karim, owner of the Melodica Music Store in downtown Nairobi.
Sorry about that. Forgot my glasses. Age creeps up.
We're in the back of his shop with a pile of old 45 RPM records.
This is a band called Olonde Family Band. There you go, there's the influence of family and whatever. And the song is called Musa Omondi. This is probably the name of some politician. It's actually in our Melodica label, so it really looks good when it's spinning.
Founded by his father in 1971, Melodica recorded tons of musicians from Kenya, Tanzania, and Congo during its heyday. The recordings left over reveal a melting pot of different musical traditions.
Some of these guys, like I said, they just learn off how to play a guitar basically on their own without any education and that. And then they just come up with their own kind of beats and then say, all right, we're going to go and, you know, sell a goat and head off into Nairobi and go find a recording music store. And bam, they would be at the door entrance, you know, playing their guitars, trying to impress. It's really amazing.
Throughout the 70s and 80s, Karim says the store was packed with musicians as people crowded the sidewalks outside, listening to the music being pumped out on the streets. Then came the 1990s. As cassettes and CDs replaced records, the last vinyl pressing plant in Nairobi closed down. And as families sold off or threw out their record players, music recorded at Melodica and other stores was locked away on vinyl discs. But the vinyl dry season may be coming to an end.
Thank you.
Install number 570 at Nairobi's Kenyatta Market amidst the smoky haze of roasted meat. James Rugami has been selling records since 1989. Customers flip in and out as a Congolese record spins on the turntable.
8 years ago, there were people who thought I was crazy. They could come over and have a look and say, what are we keeping this for? But today, they're coming back and appreciating. I'm so happy because even very, very young people.
Rugami is seeing a vinyl renaissance in Kenya. He says his sales have been up by 40% over the past 2 years. Both Rugami and Karim say they are making contact with people all over the world who are looking for African records. Facebook groups have formed in Kenya, and enthusiasts have started holding monthly listening parties. Karim has even started ordering new turntables from China to help satisfy the growing demand. And slowly but surely, the old sounds of East Africa are rising from the past. Gabe Joselo, VOA News, Nairobi.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next is our VOA editorial. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Armed militants in Mali have stepped up attacks against the United Nations peacekeeping mission and Malian security forces, continuing a deadly campaign aimed at destabilizing the West African nation. The militants laid siege to a hotel in central Mali last week, leaving 17 people dead. The attack began early August 7th and ended after 24 hours when Malian security forces stormed the hotel in the city of Savare. The assailants killed 9 civilians, 5 of whom worked as contractors for the UN mission, and 4 Malian soldiers. An unknown number of attackers died in the assault. On August 9th, gunmen killed 10 civilians in a village in northern Mali. And on August 10th, 3 Malian soldiers were killed in central Mali when their patrol vehicle hit a landmine. These incidents show that despite the peace agreement signed in June between northern armed groups and the government, much work still needs to be done to restore security to the country. The United States commends all parties, the government of Mali, the CMA, and the platform, for their commitment to resolving their differences through dialogue, not violence. Implementing the peace agreement won't be easy or immediate. It will require dedication and steady, sustained attention in order to succeed. We urge all parties to commit to resolving future differences through the mechanisms within the accord. The parties have arrived at this agreement through a patient process of dialogue and negotiation. This peace will be achieved through hard work, mutual understanding, and cooperation. We urge all parties to the agreement to maintain the same patience, dialogue, and will to reconcile differences as they move forward.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joba.
Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.
From Washington, this is VOA News.